Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to It's Rainmaking Time. This is Kim Greenhouse. It's very exciting to be doing a climate show with Joseph Dalio. If you don't know about him, Joseph Dalio participated in my first show on climate with Robert Felix and Dr. Timothy Ball, and it was the most powerful show that went all across the world and is still going across the world from last year. I've invited Joseph Dalio back because he is so knowledgeable about climate and all the different areas of climate. He has one of the most popular websites on climate in the world called icecap.us. Joseph Dalio was the first director of meteorology at the cable TV Weather Channel. He has over 30 years' experience in professional meteorology. He was the chief meteorologist at the Weather Services International Corporation, and he was senior editor of Dr. Dewpoint for WSI's popular Intellicast.com website. He's also been a college professor of meteorology at Linden State College. He's authored and presented a number of papers, as well as published a book focused on advanced applications enabled by new technologies and how research into ENSO and other atmospheric and oceanic phenomena has made skillful seasonal forecasts possible. He is a certified consultant meteorologist, and he is elected a fellow of the American Meteorological Society. He served as a member and a chairman of the American Meteorological Society Committee on Weather Analysis and Forecasting. He is one of the most sought upon people in the world to understand the context of climate. And recently with Anthony Watts, he has just authored Surface Temperature Records, A Policy-Driven Deception, a blockbuster that will definitely introduce you to the deception that's going on with climate and weather. Let me say no more. Welcome Joseph Dalio to It's Rainmaking Time. Good morning.
Good morning, Kim. Thank you.
Thank you for being here. Talk about this new report that you did with Anthony Watts. What is the essence of it? Why is it important, and why should everybody download it from your site?
Well, after the release of the emails in the UK in what is now called ClimateGate, those emails came out of the East Anglia University in the UK and were very damning to the scientific community that has been a proponent of man-made global warming. Our government and the EPA try to distance themselves from that report and from the IPCC in Congress, and pointed to NOAA and NASA, our own government agencies responsible for monitoring global temperatures, as being their sources of data because their data was so reliable. Both Anthony and I have been working for a number of years uncovering all of the issues with all three databases. Those are the three centers, the one in East Anglia University, NOAA's in Asheville, North Carolina, and NASA in New York City, where they compile global temperatures and each month announce what the month average temperature was globally and how it ranked. Now, we found they all suffered from the same issues, and we thought we needed to publicize the problems that exist with the NOAA and NASA databases to show that we can't trust those to make important policy decisions, especially ones that are going to cost a lot of money for corporations, but also for individuals at this time, especially with the economy under such stress.
But I have a question, because the audience could feel for a second that maybe this is a partisan agenda that you have. Is it a partisan agenda? Is it pure science? What is your main issue with NOAA and NASA and East Anglia?
Our main issue is the misuse of the science and allowing issues to persist that produce a bias, and it's not partisan. The people I've worked with are not any particular part of the spectrum. There's a wide range from far left to far right to the center. This is not a partisan issue.
For some reason, it seems like in the traditional newspapers and broadcast agencies that it's translated as a partisan issue in the way that the area of climate is being spoken about. Mm-hmm. For example, a president gets up and says, the issue is resolved. Al Gore says, the issue is resolved. The science is settled. Why isn't the science settled?
For one, the factors that really drive the science are not well understood. The climate models are failing miserably in a lot of respects. They did not foresee the drop of temperatures in the last 9 years. We did see a blip up this year due to El Nino, but temperatures had been declining from 2001 to 2009, and even Phil Jones of the East Anglia Climate Research Unit admitted to a cooling of 0.12 degrees Celsius globally.
What does that mean to us?
It means, remember, that during this whole time, CO2 has been increasing, and they said that the only factor of importance was CO2, and you can ignore the sun and all of the other factors. CO2 is going to produce this dramatic accelerating temperature rise, and if indeed over a decade, in fact, even Phil Jones admitted, going back to 1995, there's no statistical warming. There's no warming, even though CO2 is increasing, then CO2 can't be driving the climate bus. It can't be the only factor that we need to worry about. There are other natural factors that are overriding any influence of man.
Talk about that, because, you know, when I was growing up, Joe, I always remember reading and hearing about the danger of carbon dioxide, CO2. Is it dangerous? Is it not? Give us the essence of what it is and what it isn't so we get it. Because most of us are scared of it. We grew up hearing it's terrible.
When we see these pictures of these belching smokestacks, even though the smoke that comes out is not, for the most part, anything but water vapor that's condensing, carbon dioxide is an invisible gas, it is not producing a significant effect on temperature. And in fact, it is a tremendous benefit. NASA identified over the last 50 years a 30% increase in crop yields, with 10% more arable lands due to CO2. We're finding that CO2 in Washington, D.C. area, they're finding the trees are growing 2 to 4 times faster than they did 50 years ago thanks to the CO2, because CO2 is an important factor in photosynthesis. CO2, water, and sunshine build plant cells. And so with more CO2, plants thrive. In the greenhouses where they grow the plants that you buy in the spring that you put in your garden, they pump in CO2 at 3 times the outside CO2 concentration in order to get more growth and to make the plants look more attractive and entice you to buy them. You wind up taking them home and they seem to struggle a little bit in their new environment. Part of that is temperature, but some of that is that they're not getting as much CO2. They don't do quite as well as they did in the nurseries. In a classroom setting, or say in an auditorium at a school, or during a talk at a conference where there are hundreds of people present, they've measured CO2 concentrations as high as 5,000 to 10,000 parts per million, and the atmospheric concentration is about 390 parts per million. So it gets very high in some locations because we breathe it out. We emit it in combustion, but we also are a significant source ourselves of the CO2. And it's not a pollutant, it's a plant fertilizer, and we've benefited from it. We've probably fed tens of millions of more people worldwide because of the increase in CO2 in the last 100 years than we could have had CO2 remained at very low levels.
If that's so, and I accept that that's so, and I've done other interviews which have demonstrated the science of that, how is it possible that the EPA last year deemed it a toxic pollutant? I mean, that's frightening.
Well, the EPA's finding was based on an analysis done by a team that had an agenda, and the agenda was to continue the effort to control carbon and also to control how we use energy and energy sources. The EPA is, despite many tens of thousands of comments back to their proposal, their proposed endangerment finding, challenging them on all these issues, stood their ground and proclaimed it a pollutant requiring regulation and control. There are a lot of lawsuits underway to try to block that.
I think they need to be thrown out, and I'll tell you why. They just allowed the spraying of toxic chemicals in the Gulf, and they did nothing about it. Nothing. That actually made the problem worse. Now, they're telling us that carbon, something we breathe out and plants use for nutrients and food, is toxic. It's crazy. This is crazy. And this is the basis of this new cap and trade system. This faulty seed, this lying, deceptive seed of information is the underpinning, the underbelly of this new cap and trade system. And if people get that this is a falsity, they will get that the entire system that they're building, that they brought in the head of JP Morgan Chase Did you know that? A woman who was the architect for the derivatives market with one of the architects of Enron to help create this carbon system.
Yep.
That's pretty bad. I'm not even involved politically. I'm an environmental advocate. I've always been concerned about the environment. You're talking to somebody who was in shock learning what I learned on the last maybe 200 or 300 hours of research I've done. It's frightening what's going on, because if we're breathing out carbon and they're trying to regulate it and it's food for plants, then it's all about levels. Talk about the levels again. Let's separate apples and oranges on the carbon issue, and then I want to continue with you. You said that in some places there's 5 to 10,000 parts per million of carbon dioxide.
Right.
But in the atmosphere, there's 390 parts per million. So what are we trying to regulate carbon for? Is there such a thing as a dangerous level of carbon dioxide? And if so, what is it?
It's never been reached, but they think it's something like 14 or 15,000 parts per million. We do know that in submarines, it's between 6 and 11,000 parts per million because the air is trapped in there. And then, like I said, in auditoriums, it can be 5 to 10,000 parts per million. Of course, when you open the doors and people leave, it escapes and goes back to normal. It doesn't affect people in any way, but it does benefit plants that we grow and help us with producing food. Because in addition to causing more growth, when plants are more vigorous, the soybeans and the corn and wheat, because of CO2, the biomass is greater. They've measured in sugarcane an increase of 40% in tests in some fields where they've tripled the CO2. But it also shades the ground. It becomes more drought resistant. There are fewer stomata on the plant leaves because they don't need to struggle so much to take CO2 out of the air. That means also less water vapor is evaporated into the atmosphere. So water needs are lower. Drought is less of an issue. It has so many benefits that to try to not only control it, but take it back to levels from 100 years ago, which is virtually impossible because the primary source of atmospheric CO2 isn't man. Man does introduce CO2 through breathing and combustion and other action, cement manufacturing, so forth. But the oceans are the primary sink and source, the primary reservoir of CO2.
How do you know that? Explain it to us.
Well, scientists, geologists, and oceanographers that are focused on the oceans, as one in particular, Tom Segalstad in Norway, who I know quite well, talks about the oceans as being an infinite buffer for CO2. He said you could burn all of the fossil fuels on the planet and the oceans would take up the excess CO2 so that it wouldn't increase the CO2 by more than 20%.
How come that's not a frame of reference around the world so that people that are concerned about the environment can know it?
An inconvenient fact. Their models are built in ways that give them the desired results.
Like data in, data out?
Yes.
They're simulation models, which is different from verifying facts. Is that correct?
Right. And when they look at models and models don't verify with the data, then the data must be wrong. Not their models. They always go back then and fiddle with the data to try to make the data fit their models. And this has happened again and again. I could give you many examples. But as a meteorologist with 30 years experience and heavily involved in climatology over much of that time, including when I was a professor and taught climatology and microclimatology, we look at the data and we let the data tell us what the story is. For example, if we look at record temperatures in the United States, which aren't jiggered with in the data, we look at the record state temperatures, and there are 12 months in 50 states, so there's 600 records, and you look at it by decade, the 1930s stands out like the Sears Tower. And the 1980s and 90s had a little bit of a blip upward, and the 2000s are lower than any other decade since the 1800s in terms of state heat records. And yet they're trying to tell us that their models say that heat records are increasing at an alarming rate. EPA has had several statements and stories come out with that as a theme, and it is part of their endangerment finding as to why they need to take action now because of the threat imposed by rapidly increasing heat waves. Whereas when we look at the data, we don't see that. We see a unremarkable heat story in recent years compared to the 1930s, the Dust Bowl days. They have been taking the original data and they've been adjusting that data, finding reasons to modify the data in all three data centers. Well, maybe I had to go back and talk about, as I did in the paper, about the major issues.
Yeah, talk about your paper with Anthony.
Yes, we catalog a number of major issues with the global data, including a major dropout in the number of stations. We had 75% of the stations that were used in establishing the temperature records in the 60s and 70s disappeared in 1990. It was a tenfold increase in the number of missing months in the remaining stations, creating huge holes in the data in places like Canada, South America, Africa, Siberia. And there was also no adjustment in the data for urbanization, even though it's a well-established fact. And I learned this early on in my career by an association with the father of climatology, Helmut Landsberg, who authored a book called Urban Climatology, who taught me about the urban heat island. And it's a well-established fact that cities are warmer than rural areas. And as they dropped out the stations, many of those stations that were dropped out were rural stations. Many of the stations that remained were airports. And cities have grown around airports. You can probably think of airports, and your listeners can probably relate to that, and airports near them, that the environment around those airports has changed.
And highly congested, right?
Yes, they've become congested. They put up hotels. There's more runways. There are more roadways. All of these trap heat, and as a result, temperatures rise. There's no adjustment for this change in that data. Anthony Watts is also, with a project called SurfaceStation.org, done a survey of climate stations across the whole country, and there were 1,221, and he's done well over 1,000 of those stations with a team of volunteers, and they go and they take pictures close up from all orientations and also from satellite, Google Maps, and high-resolution data, and then they compare the sighting of those instruments with the government standards, and the government has published standards for where temperature instruments ought to be sighted. And they have found that 90% of the 1,000-some-odd stations that they have surveyed do not meet the government's own standard, and all of the problems introduce a warm bias. So now you've got station dropout, missing data, no adjustment for urbanization, you've got this poor sighting of stations, and if that isn't bad enough, they do a final adjustment, partly because now they've created a lot of holes in the data by searching around and looking at other stations. They call it an homogenization process. You almost always wind up averaging in fast-growing cities with rural cities, and the result is a warming. But it is mainly in recent years that you get a warming, and the result of all of these changes that they've made has been to cool off by 2 or 3 tenths of a degree the 1930s, the 1940s, 1950s, pretty much eliminating that warm blip back in the middle part of last century. And so that accentuates the apparent warming that we've got in the last 2 decades. With all these issues, it almost guarantees that every month will rank in the top 10 warmest ever. Even this winter, if you recall, when in the United States, it was a brutal winter all across the South. Some places the coldest ever in Texas, and the coldest in 77, 78 in a lot of places. And also in the UK and Russia and parts of Siberia was the coldest ever on record. In China, the coldest in 71, 72. So here we had a very cold Northern Hemisphere temperature picture. The winter ranked in the top 5 warmest ever, according to the global data centers. Because of all these other issues that have accentuated an apparent warming in recent years and downplayed the real warming that took place in the early part of the century. In our paper, we have shown how, with pictures and graphs and charts, how this plays out.
How come it is that the impact of the sun is not part of the analysis?
It's astounding to me. As much as I was influenced by Dr. Landsberg, I also was influenced early on in my career by 2 other people, Herd Willett, who was a MIT professor who believed in solar cycles and attended one of my first organized conferences, and we sat and talked for a long time, and he believed in many different cycles in the sun, and believed the temperatures would be seen to correlate very well with that. with the proper analysis. And we have ourselves looked at the solar factor, and other scientists have too, and found a very strong correlation with the sun on a long-term basis and over the centuries and millennia, but also over the last 100 years. There is a variance of 60-year cycle that matches the temperature cycle very well. The other person who influenced me was Jerome Namias, who was the first director of long-range forecasting at the National Weather Service back in the 1950s. He then moved on to Scripps Oceanographic in California, where he was the director. And he told me about the importance of the oceans. We already knew a little bit about El Nino, but he said, you know, even the mid and high latitude ocean is characterized by large warm and cold pools that tend to persist for a long period of time. And they kind of anchor the jet stream so that you wind up with a predominance of, say, cold temperatures, as you've seen in the western United States this spring and early summer, and warm temperatures in the next downstream ridge over the eastern U.S. is, you know, the 100-degree temperatures that occurred in parts of the east in recent weeks. And last year, a very different configuration of the jet stream when the temperatures were different. So the oceans, we believe, are driven by the sun. The sun drives the oceans to go into these modes, and these sun and the ocean work together to control the weather that we...
The weather or the climate?
Both.
Okay.
The climate, for sure. Weather can vary. Last winter was one of the colder winters for the U.S. as a whole. We averaged 2.2 degrees Fahrenheit below normal for the U.S. for the over 48 states. That's a rather significant cold winter. But there was some breaks in that. That's weather.
What's the difference between climate and weather? Because we talk about them often synonymously.
Climate is what you expect and weather is what you get, I guess, is the easiest way to put it. Climate is an average or mean and range of conditions for a given location for a particular time of year, whereas weather is what actually does take place and can vary, as you know, very much. Even day to day, weather can be very different from the normal. And that's basically what they're looking at. They're looking at departures from the normal.
But isn't climate something that's measured over long periods of time versus
yes, exactly.
Weather is what happens that day?
They all use different base periods. The satellite groups that measure temperatures globally with satellites had data available starting in 1979. They used 1979 to 1998 averages as their normals. NOAA uses the whole data period from 1895 to the current as their normal, the average during that time, and they compute an average temperature for a location or for the world and compare it to that long-term average. And that's what they focus on for climate change, is what they call anomalies or departures from average.
I have a question about the solar cycles, and then I want to go back and talk to you about cement and greenhouse gases again. What I've heard is that the solar cycles directly connect and relate to tremendous cooling or tremendous heating. Is that correct?
Yes.
Do you know what solar cycle we're in now?
We're in cycle number 24. First one they started counting was in the 1700s. Cycle 23 lasted 12.7 years, which is 3 years longer than the prior two cycles, 2 to 3 years longer. Very unusually long and quiet cycle. We had over 802, I believe, sun-spotless days, days where even with the best satellites on many places around the world, we couldn't spot a dark sunspot on the surface of the sun for a calendar day. And
what does that mean to us?
Well, sun-spotless days and long cycles are characteristic of a cooling climate. We saw such a behavior in the early 1900s. We saw a mini version of that in the 1960s and 70s, which maybe accounted for the cooling that we saw then, but a much more significant solar quiet period in the early 1900s, but especially the early 1800s and late 1700s, a period that was called the Dalton Minimum.
Is that a solar minimum?
Solar minimum, right. Even the peaks of the solar cycles were very low with not many sunspots, and so there was less output from the sun. It was a period of cold weather. It was the age of Dickens when children played in the snow in London on a regular basis in winter, and even the Thames River froze over from time to time. Well, in the last few years, you've probably seen in the news pictures of snow in London and England, and people saying, we're not used to this, what's going on? it could be the sun, is a factor there.
Do you think we're headed into an ice age like Robert Felix does? Or do you feel that we're headed into challenging times that are getting colder and colder? What's your perspective?
I believe that we're heading to at least the Dalton minimum kind of cooling, which could be a degree or two Celsius globally over the next couple of decades.
What does that mean, a degree or two Celsius?
Oh, about 3 degrees Fahrenheit globally. It means summers are, you know, you're still going to get your heat waves, but on average, summers will be cooler, winters will be colder and longer, more extreme. There'll be plenty of snow, and snow in places like last winter where you don't often get snow. The issue is that colder is much worse than warm. They want to stop carbon dioxide and stop this dangerous warming that's measured in tenths of a degree. The average person could not tell the difference between 56 and 57 degrees, and yet they want to tell us that's catastrophic in that kind of a global average mean temperature change. But 3 degrees cooling is significant, and what it would do, probably the worst impact would be on agriculture.
I was going to say crops.
Crops, because you get longer winters, and that means that you get late frosts, and they have to replant, and then you get early frosts, and maybe it catches the plant before it's mature, and the Dalton minimum, and even more so the Maunder minimum, which was an even deeper solar minimum in the 16, 1700s, is characterized by a lot of crop failures and famines worldwide.
So we're preparing for the wrong stuff, really.
Yeah,
most of us are preparing for massive heat. First of all, it's not happening. Second of all, the data is simulated data. It's not the real data. And third, we're preparing for something that's not occurring and not going to occur.
That's right. That's our belief. And yes, we got this break this spring and summer coming off of the very, very cold winter in the Northern Hemisphere. But La Nina is coming back. The Pacific is very definitely in its cold mode, and that's usually a precursor of a cool spell. It's probably reflecting those downdraft in the solar activity. Even today, the solar minimum was reached in December 2008, and we're a year and a half, 8 months into the new solar cycle, and it's struggling. There's an increase. There are some sunspots, but certainly not a very active sun, which is rather typical of recent cycles a couple of years after the minimum. In fact, some of them reach the maximum within 3 years of the solar minimum. And we're still more active, but likely to peak out, I think, somewhere in the 40 to 70 maximum sunspot area. Put that in perspective, the last solar cycle was 120, and the prior one was in the 150s. And in the early 1800s, it was in the 40s.
What are these numbers you're giving?
Average monthly sunspot number.
Okay, got it.
And back in the Maunder minimum, what they called the little ice ages in the 1500s, 1600s, they went many decades at a time without seeing sunspots. The sun just was absent of these sunspots, and the result was a very significant cooling back then. And the Thames River froze on a very regular basis, and they used to have ice parties on the Thames River as an annual winter event. And the canals in the Netherlands froze every year, and ice skating was common. But they had their issues there. That was the famines, the plagues, the crop failures. Those are characteristic of these cooling eras. Not very attractive. We can hope it's a Dalton minimum. And what warmth we've added through urban growth and population growth on the planet, maybe will ease a little bit the pain of the cooling, but we believe strongly a cooling is coming now, not further warming, certainly no catastrophic warming.
Let's talk about greenhouse gases. As a greenhouse, I take homage to the fact that greenhouse gases are bad. They can be on a personal note, but on a climate note, let's talk about what it is. Let's define it. Let's separate the wheat from the chaff. What is a greenhouse gas?
Well, greenhouse gases include water vapor, the primary greenhouse gas, carbon dioxide, methane, some of the chlorofluorocarbons and hydrochlorocarbons that allegedly absorb heat that's given off from the surface of the earth after the earth is warmed by the sun, and trap it in the atmosphere, and then we radiate it back, some to space, but some back to the Earth. But the satellite measures radiation going in and going out very accurately, and the satellites are telling us that they've overestimated the importance of these greenhouse gases, what's called sensitivity, rather significantly, because the satellite's seeing virtually as much coming out from the atmosphere and Earth combined as is going in.
So is that true across the board, like all over the world?
These are averaged over the Earth, and so the result is that they believe the sensitivity of the atmosphere to these greenhouse gases is much less than is modeled. The models also fail because they know that carbon dioxide is a trace gas. Only 0.038% of our atmosphere is CO2, and man only accounts for 3% of that.
Sorry, I want to stop you for a minute. Give us that first number again.
0.038% of our atmosphere by volume is carbon dioxide.
What does that mean to us, 0.038% of our atmosphere is carbon dioxide? One half?
It means
one quarter?
A very minor component. The atmosphere is primarily nitrogen, oxygen, argon, and water vapor are next in importance. Carbon dioxide is way down the list as a component of the atmosphere. It's not a lot. And if the models only included the carbon dioxide warming, even with their exaggerated sensitivity, the warming they'd show over the next century would not be alarming. It would be half a degree or so. They couldn't obviously get countries to inflict pain on their people with that kind of a warming, because if people thought that we've got to stop this 1 degree warming, people would say, well, why? You know, it's hardly noticeable. But so they built into these models a lot of what we call positive feedbacks. They say, well, when you warm the atmosphere, you increase the water vapor and you change the cloud picture. And these work together to trap even more heat and amplify the warming. You get a lot of high clouds, which reflects the Earth's heat that's trying to escape, and the result is a much amplified warming. That's how you get your models that predict 11 to 13, 14 degree warming, you know, over the next century. But these models are failing. In the first decade of the century, we've seen a cooling. So even one of the key lead authors of the IPCC report and a major player in this climate community, Kevin Trenberth, who works for the National Center for Atmospheric Research and NOAA, said it's a travesty that we can't explain the lack of heating.
I'm sorry I'm laughing, but after you look at every single aspect of this, it just turns into a theme, an agenda theme, and it's very hard to digest because you have falsities at every level of this, every single level. Most of the public has digested this all as climate facts. Climate realities. We have to control the climate. We have to fix the climate. And then this is all kind of thrown in like a soup. The climate change is now a condition and a problem. It's not a cycle.
Right.
We are terrible as humans to, quote, kill the planet. I love the planet. I love animals. I love plants. I love nature just like you and everybody else. Most people love the earth.
I've been an environmentalist all my life, as of you. I'm a conservationist. You should see what I do to try to maintain minimal energy usage around my home with insulated siding and insulated garage doors and front doors. And we're very careful about the energy that we use. We burn wood in the winter to supplement. You know, we recycle everything. We're as much in favor of being good stewards of our environment as anyone associated with any of the environmental groups. But that doesn't mean we're not going to look objectively at the data and report back what we find.
I've just heard that there's a bill in Congress to now tell us that we cannot use certain light bulbs, that we can only use a certain kind of light bulbs. And even the light bulbs we're now going to be instructed and forced to use are toxic. They're totally toxic. It's
right.
Unbelievable.
The incandescent bulb is going to be outlawed. We'll need to use a compact fluorescent bulb that they thought was such a wonderful idea.
It's terrible for you. Terrible.
Mercury, and if you happen to drop it on the floor, they tell you to get your children out of the house. In some places, they actually require you to call in a hazmat group to come clean it up at great expense to you. And when these lights eventually burn out, people will be throwing them into the trash and they'll be going into our waste dumps and we'll be polluting our waste dumps with mercury.
This is truly an agenda in the works. It's obvious it's an agenda. Next thing you know, the EPA will be regulating oxygen. Seriously, If they can do it with carbon, they can do it with oxygen.
Well, they did it with sulfur dioxide, and Enron made a lot of money from that. And that gave Enron the idea that, boy, if we could do the same with carbon, just think of all the money we can make. And they went to Al Gore and Bill Clinton and told them that we need to figure out how to control carbon and carbon dioxide. And Clinton thought that they were nuts, but Gore believed it, and the rest is history. The primary driver for pushing this carbon tax is carbon trading, and the big corporations, a lot of which are involved heavily with the administration.
Probably Goldman Sachs. We know J.P. Morgan.
Yes, GE.
Also involved in light bulbs.
Yes, exactly, and windmills and solar. And they own a lot of...
radio and television.
Right. They own a lot of the original rights for carbon trading that Enron held. They all see an opportunity to make a lot of money. Also, the Chicago Carbon Trading Exchange, who, by the way, was the lawyer that helped to get that established, was Barack Obama.
Is that correct?
That is correct.
Is that verifiable?
Valerie Jarrett, one of his advisors, is on that board.
Who is that?
Valerie Jarrett.
God, this is really a connected matrix, isn't it?
It really is. And that's why they continue to push for this carbon, even though the public is not believing it anymore.
Don't you think a lot of people still are duped about global warming and are scared to death? I can't tell you how many people I see on Facebook and Twitter and the social networks that are saying we're killing our planet. I resent being told I'm killing the planet. That is just a falsity to declare that and to continue to repeat that over and over into consciousness.
And every time you challenge them and try to explain otherwise, they right away accuse you of being bought and paid for. You must be a shill for big oil. You're obviously in it for the money. And we say, no, we're not. We're trying to spread the truth so that we don't make a mistake, because you start imposing these carbon restrictions on it. Yes, it may initially be only the biggest utilities, but even then, cost of energy goes up. Remember, the president himself said the cost of gasoline is going to skyrocket. Gas is going to skyrocket, and it will. They've estimated increases in the cost of energy of 70% or greater, and that affects everybody. That's a tax that affects the poor and middle probably more than it does higher-income individuals. And it's not a real tax on you directly. It's an indirect tax because your cost of energy goes up. But when the cost of energy goes up, and never mind the fact that eventually the regulations will spread to smaller and smaller emitters so that eventually even churches and supermarkets will be paying taxes and will have to be filling out paperwork and have controls imposed on how they operate and what energy they use and so forth. But as you increase the cost of energy, there's a domino effect.
Absolutely. Cascading.
It's not a value-added tax, but in actual fact, it almost is, because it costs more for factories to produce what they produce, more to get the goods to the factories and from the factories to wholesale and retail stores because transportation costs are higher. It costs more for these stores to operate because the cost to warm and cool the stores goes up. And if they have an extra tax on them imposed because they're big enough Walmart to emit enough CO2 to cross that threshold.
Who's imposing the taxes?
No one is imposing the taxes. Well, the EPA would regulate the levels at which CO2 must be kept, and there'll be penalties, and which are basically taxes imposed that will go to the government.
That's terrible. Terrible.
It comes from our pockets. And even though they can say, we never increased your income tax, yes, but the cost of living, I've seen estimates from anywhere from a couple of thousand to as much as $6,000 per family per year more from, we used to call it cap and tax rather than cap and trade. Well, they got smart and they found out that the public didn't understand what cap and trade meant, and we were using cap and tax. It made it look like a tax. And so they call it something, the American Power Act or Clean Energy Act.
It's terrible how they've hijacked the environmental movement. Terrible.
Right.
It's a disgrace. When I think about they're going to force us to use toxic light bulbs,
right,
that they pour terribly toxic, vile materials into the Gulf. The EPA let that happen. And then they turn around and they call carbon a toxin. This is a fraudulent organization. I can't even believe we allow them to exist.
You know, as much as I'm all for alternative energy, and I think there's some promise in solar and locally in wind, wind power is a major issue, and it helped create the problems that they have in Europe because they all bought into the green agenda and pushed for solar and wind power.
I can see the attraction, can't you?
And, sure.
At the conceptual and level.
Spain looked at it after a number of years of implementing this high degree of subsidization of solar and wind, and they found that Dr. Calzada, Juan Marcos University, did a study, found that for every green job that was created in the process of this renewable energy push, they lost 2.2 real jobs because the cost of energy skyrocketed and the big corporations said, we can't afford to do business here anymore. So they built plants in India or China or someplace else in the world, and workers were left out on the street. And for every 10 green jobs that were created building windmills, only one was permanent. Because once you build the windmills, you don't need the contractors to stand around anymore. They have to wait for the next opportunity. And they found that the unemployment rose to 18.7 or 9% in Spain, and now they're backing off of that. A similar experience in Denmark, a similar experience in Germany, Italy. I spoke to at a conference a scientist who did a similar study and found the same results in Italy. But worse than all of that is the environmental movement has been totally silent, especially World Wildlife Fund and the groups that deal with animals, on what windmills do to bird life and bats. Greenpeace had sued ExxonMobil for 6 birds that were found in an oil tank that had drowned and got $600,000 in fines imposed. Well, it's been estimated anywhere from 200,000 to 1 million birds a year will be killed by windmills in this country, including, and they're finding it in the UK as well, including the high-value birds, the golden eagles, the bats, which are very valuable and eating insects, are being killed by the hundreds of thousands as well.
There's another side to the wind, though, Joe, that I think you know, but you may not be talking about, which is I was always very excited about wind power. I had just believed everything I had heard about it. And then I did an interview some months ago about wind power and found out that a lot of the big energy and lighting companies are involved in this. And it actually ends up costing more money and taxes the grid more to use wind. And so there's a whole economical side of it that's never really been analyzed on a detail level.
You're exactly right. They found the same thing in Denmark and Spain, Italy, that they could not close a single fossil fuel plant where they put up windmills because the wind was too erratic and unpredictable. And you can't have your lights dim or go out. You have to maintain a constant energy. So they had to keep fossil fuel plants in ready backup mode or in production and integrate wind into the grid. The CO2 emissions from these coal and oil power plants in their less efficient modes actually resulted in an increase in the CO2 by 36% in one country and 50%, I believe, in Denmark. So it didn't solve the problem of CO2. It killed birds and bats, but it underdelivered on the amount of energy it provided and cost jobs and didn't save any fossil fuel. So as much as I was an early endorser of wind and solar as a supplement, always thought of it as a supplement, not as a primary source, but I have cooled a lot on wind power as a reliable source. Perhaps in the middle of the desert, along with solar panels, it makes sense, but not anywhere near people. There are also health hazards. They've found wind turbines make a humming noise that causes people to have headaches, migraines, to not be able to sleep.
I didn't know that.
Yes.
I didn't know that at all.
So that's another downside to the wind. But
I'm for Tesla, the work that Tesla did. I'm for advanced energy systems and methods. And I'm a big believer that energy really was created to be free and that this shouldn't even be used in a form of accounting. It's absurd. We live at a time where we should be living as human beings in a very advanced, highly matured, evolved way. And there's no reason to have a cost associated with energy. It's unnecessary. And with the physics that's now known, the biophotonic work, the things that we now know in electromagnetics are so advanced, and even the information that's kept from us that's very advanced by DARPA and others, we really have everything already. Energy should be a non-cost item. And I don't just believe in setting up more of the same of something that continues to grow and escalate in its cost. It's unnecessary. I'm very much interested in establishing a parallel economy that doesn't function from the same paradigm of thinking that we're entrenched in. Because what you and I are really talking about is separating the wheat from the chaff, apples from oranges, making distinctions, making things clear so that people can see the real light of the situation.
Right.
And not be smothered by and ingesting a falsity about what's happening. But the reality is that energy doesn't have to have a cost. That's the first part of a new paradigm. Why does it have to have a cost? And if it does, it should be so inexpensive if it's advanced. It doesn't have to be expensive. And there you have, when you have an economy of scale and you have a paradigm that uses the Tesla technology. And there's a reason why Raytheon filed for the patents of Tesla when he died. Took his weather engineering, took a lot of his patents, and the military industrial complex owns it. There's a reason. There's a reason for that. And so we all talk about renewables, but can you imagine that the sun is left out of the equation of weather and climate? And you and Anthony Watts wrote up about these surface stations. They don't even tell the public the true state of these stations, and that all this has to be dug up and put together and found out and explained to the public. And yet many people are going to be completely hypnotized by what a presidential leader will say or what a regulatory agency will say. And here we are at a time where what we're talking about is a potential for mass enslavement. And we live at a time where we can do better. We can do a lot better.
A lot better. I agree with you.
What is your wish for the next few years? What is it that you would like to see happen?
I would like, as one of the professors at the University of East Anglia said, that ClimateGate turns out to be a turning point, a game changer, and researchers become more upfront, open, and explicit, and we start looking at the reality in terms of the real drivers for climate, that we also stop this nonsense of thinking we have all the answers on energy, and the answers are batteries that go into cars, as if the electricity that feeds the batteries isn't produced by a fossil fuel plant, the nonsense there, that we incent corporations like Raytheon to move the ball forward in developing the true alternative energy sources, improving the solar. Some improvements have been made in recent years that make it much more efficient. But not ignore what we know about using the wealth of resources this country has in terms of coal, natural gas, tar sands, and oil offshore, and convert that to clean coal.
Does clean coal really exist? Because I heard it doesn't really exist, and it's just a package name. What is it?
There's a plant, I believe, in Montana. The technology exists to gasify or liquefy it and produce clean fuel, natural gas, basically, from coal. They use this in Germany as well, and we can do that. It has been not cost-effective, but if energy costs rise, it will become much more cost-effective. And also, it has not been frowned on. The powers that be seem to be enamored by ethanol from corn and also sun and wind.
Using food, I think ethanol is one of the biggest wastes of money. It's going to ruin farms. It's going to ruin rural areas.
Right. I was in Brazil where they use sugarcane and much more efficiently in ethanol, and I drove in a car that was powered by natural gas, much higher miles per gallon, averages the equivalent of 50 miles per gallon in the cab that I drove. They're further along in the proper use of alternative energy than we are in this country, surprisingly.
So people should go to your site, icecap.us, and what is that site about?
Well, we look at all sides of the climate issue and the politics that's involved, but also new papers that come out, talk about the sun, the ocean, talk about when NOAA comes out with a statement about the month being the warmest ever. We did a story today. It's actually in the USA Today mentioned that and quoted me in that story. But we look at the politics of it. We look at media and how the media is handling the issue, and not very well, usually. We have a wealth of information in the library of close to 4,500 stories that we've assembled over the last 3 years, and all of that is searchable. We try to keep people up to date as to the state of the climate. And periodically, we'll talk about what we expect short and long term as we go forward in the future, both on a weather basis, but also on a climate basis. And we will be updating that story, Anthony and I, as new information is put together. We are looking at showing people how they've modified the temperatures from a couple of decades ago to the current in graphical form so they can see very clearly how the data has been manipulated. That'll soon be a paper that will be there and hopefully published elsewhere.
Thank you so much for being a guest on It's Rainmaking Time. It's an honor and a pleasure to know you and to be able to talk with you and to be educated by you and others. And thank you so much. Ladies and gentlemen, you can reach Joe Dalio at icecap.us. Thank you again, Joe, for being on the show. And is there anything else you'd like to say?
No, thank you very much, Kim, for what you're doing.